Shavua Tov. Winter's back. We drove up north, you know, where we live in the south, coming north, there was snow. But anyways, welcome. Potchim b'chvod l'chsanya, I want to thank BAYT, Elaine Genesov, Rabbi Karofkin for organizing this. When Rabbi Karofkin heard that Rabbi Glickman was coming, he sent me an email if he could speak at the Beit. He apologized he wasn't going to be here. And I want to thank him, and you're in for a real treat. Rabbi Ozer Glickman is a Magid Shir, a Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva University. He this year is giving a Yoredeya Shir for Smicha students. He teaches in the Sai Sim School of Business and Halakha. He teaches in the Law School of Yeshiva University. And that's what keeps him occupied on for part of his time. Ozer Glickman is the former treasurer of CIBC. Before that, he was the head of arbitrage, you know, trading at Chemical Bank. He's founder of a hedge fund and many other investments in the corporate world. He serves today as a consultant for major companies and on risk management and investment. And of course, Rabbi Ozer Glickman and Tony Glickman are one and the same person. And it's really an honor and a pleasure. It's extremely rare that I've met such a multi-talented and faceted person. I'm not even talking about how he plays piano and all the other talents that he has, but really it's a pleasure being having him over the weekend on Shabbat, and really one of the experts on finance and halakha, and it's a pleasure to welcome him. Speak. Okay. I was going to mention he has a wicked sense of humor, okay. But you already heard that. Okay.
So I have to say, after a number of formal shiurim and traditional divrei Torah, Rabbi Kelman and I thought that this evening I might let down whatever hair I have left and speak personally. And this is particularly appropriate for me in Toronto, which I have to say was the scene of many of the happiest years of my career. I would come up on a Tuesday morning every week for 8 years, and I would fly back on Thursday night. I had an apartment at University in Wellington. I had maid service, and the difference between home and the apartment was that the maid didn't boss me around like the one in Teaneck does. And, and the bank's limo would go out to King Solomon's Table of Blessed Memory and bring me back dinner every night. And I had two good friends that I learned with on Tuesday and Wednesday evenings, and I had a really wonderful time. I do want to mention sitting here is my niece. You don't mind if I introduce you, Aliza Weintraub-Braverman, and my great niece, not my good niece, but my great niece, Atara, and my nephew-in-law, Jason Braverman, and they live right across the street, and it's a pleasure for me to be able to see them. And I also have sitting here the daughter of one of my good friends in Teaneck who comes to all my shirim and gives me rough time always because he's a flaming liberal, and he always gives me a rough time in anything that I say, and he keeps me honest, and that's my good friend Joseph Kaplan, and it's nice to finally meet his daughter. And he's also the brother of one of my idols in the, you know, Lawrence Kaplan, one of the major figures in Jewish thought in the modern Orthodox world. So it's nice to be here. I wanted to say that the truth is that after leaving CIBC in February 2002, which is what happened, is I was supposed to be at a conference on September 11th, 2001. I was supposed to be in the World Trade Center, and what happened was the night before was Slichus, and I was up late, and I went to Rinat for Slichus, and I overslept when the limo was banging on the door, the driver was banging on the door, so I got to the World Trade Center. I was supposed to be in Windows on the World, the very top, and what saved me is my own irresponsibility, because when I got there, it was already late, and so I said, I'll go up for the second session. So I went across the street to my downtown office, which is right down there. I went to get a coffee, And while I'm there, I get all cell service suddenly stops, and I get a call from my son, who was in the Israeli army at the time, and he says to me, go outside. I said, Ron, we speak Hebrew, but I said to him, and I'll translate, I said, I can't, I'm talking to somebody, having coffee with somebody. He says, go outside. So he says, what do you see? I said, oh, my God, it looks like a little corporate plane hit the World Trade Center. He says, that's because you're on the ground. It's actually a full-size jet, and there's another one headed there. And he, because he was in military intelligence in Israel, so he said, you know, walk along the water. He said, don't go anywhere near the Empire State Building. Walk along the water in case something comes and you have to jump in or something. And I walked uptown, and I went to my Midtown office, and then I waited to see if my son, who was in Goldman Sachs, if he would meet me there, if he'd know, because nobody could reach anybody. All the stuff was out. So the day after, I had been signed out to go to this conference at the World Trade Center. So I actually was home, and I picked up the phone, and it was a senior executive, very senior executive from CIBC, was calling to wish my wife condolences, and he was a little shocked when I answered the phone. And I'll just tell you, in the presence of friends, he sounded a little disappointed. But in any case, I told him that I would leave the bank, and he said, stay till the next Fed audit, because I was a very high American in the bank, and I did, and I haven't been as happy, really, until very recently. I have to say that Toronto is a wonderful, hospitable place with a gentility that's unknown in other large cities, I've really found. And just go into a coffee shop and see how the people queue up and don't push. You know, now I'm going back to New York, you know, and I make my way there, but I'm just the Ontario civility is very well noted, and I think it's a wonderful, place to be. Let me add also that Toronto has supplied many of the very best students that I've taught in Yeshiva University, actually. And I've had wonderful students from Or Chaim and from Toronto, and I cherish them. I said today in Or Chaim in the Minyan that I was actually wearing the product. I was in Beit Shemesh a number of years ago, and when my colleague and Rebbe, Rav Herschel Schechter, convinced me to start wearing techelet, you know, on my talus. So I bought some techelet, and I had to put on the talus, and I'm not a handy person. So I was in Ramat Beit Shemesh, and I stopped at a yeshiva where the Rosh Yeshiva were friends of mine. They went to YU. And I said, gee, can you guys help me tie the techelet? And they said, oh, the Or Chaim boys are excellent in tying techelet. So I actually have the product of their skills, and I'm grateful to Toronto for sending so many fine young men and women, because I've taught in Stern on occasion as well. I'm a very big proponent of women's learning. I just was Tuesday night in this past week was, sorry, Monday evening in Stern to teach, to give a shiur in Gemara. I teach very often in the graduate program for Torah studies in Stern, and and the products of Toronto are really legendary. This is how I'd like to proceed this evening. I have a handful of ideas that I made some notes that I'd like to share. A lot of them have to do with things that I've learned over the course of my career. And I think that there are in there some valuable lessons. The kids in YU, particularly in Cy Sims, seem to find it helpful to talk to me about careers. And what I do in the summertime when the kids have internships, I spend Tuesday and Thursday afternoons in Gregory's or Starbucks, those are coffee places, and I sit there, and kids know they can stop by, bring your resume, I'll talk to you, tell me about what you're doing in business, I can help you, I'll help you do a LinkedIn profile, I'll tell you where you can look for a better job. So I want to share some of those things, but I wanted to say that the format is, I have a note to always have two gratuitous jokes about my wife's family, so I will put those in as well. And but I am going to pause a few times, because if you have an over-the-top compliment for me, you're certainly welcome to interrupt me. Okay. So when I was a little boy, I'm going to tell my niece stuff that she doesn't know, actually. You know, when I was a little boy, my parents already knew what I would be. or at least what they wanted me to be. So my father, who was an academic, was set on my being a rabbi. My mother was set on my being an academic. So whenever I would say I wanted to do something, my father would say, maybe I could be a lawyer. My father would say, and a rabbi. And then I'd say to my mother, I'm thinking about the law. And my mother would say, and teaching the law, right? So they knew always what I would be. So it's no surprise that my earliest plans, particularly a kid whose father died right after his high school graduation, that, you know, you get the idea that you're going to live your life in tribute to your father, and particularly when your mother tells you that you're not going to go to the school you wanted to go to, you're going to go to Columbia because your father wanted to go to Columbia and it was a depression and he wasn't able to go. So now you're going to fulfill his dream and go to Columbia and you're going to be a rabbi, you know. So she gave in on that in tribute. And I actually, always loved Torah study, and that's where I was headed until I realized that Rabbi Kropkin laughed when I told him this, that I actually didn't want to be a rabbi. I never wanted to be a congregational rabbi. I'd be an awful congregational rabbi. One, because I'm not the least bit political. I say exactly what, as Rabbi Kelman found out today, I say exactly what's on my mind. You know, that's the first thing. And the second thing is I couldn't be in a career where my job would be somebody else's hobby. Right? I very much didn't like that. I didn't like the idea that I'd be working for a urologist would be my boss and not another rabbi. So I don't have anything against urologists. As I get to be older, you know, they look more attractive to me. But the fact is that I didn't want to do something that in the not-for-profit sector. So I told my mother at one point. And I started, I was a very young academic, and I graduated college and graduate school very, very young. And I was already teaching, I already taught a graduate level course when I was in my early 20s. So, and I could see I didn't want to be an academic because I thought my interest was in studying Torah. It wasn't in teaching undergraduates the same stuff every year. Now, since then, I've actually moved from teaching graduate students to undergraduates, and I'll tell you later why what I get out of teaching undergraduates, why it's so energizing for me. But I wanted to, I was more interested, I was a selfish person, I was more interested in my own study of Torah than I was in, you know, advancing other people's children's interest in Torah, which that's sort of changed. And, the only things that I knew about, as most kids do, when I tell them this in YU all the time, the only jobs I knew about were the jobs that my parents knew about. And that's what happens. You talk to kids, you say, what do you want to do? He says, I'm going to be a real estate developer. I said, so how long has your father been a real estate developer, right? So the fact of the matter is the models that these kids have are the things that they hear at home. And college is a time to experiment with different things. So I told my mother, I had a chavrusa, a study partner, the study Talmud with, who was brilliant. He had smicha from YU, and he was the biggest Ginnie Mae trader on Wall Street. And he actually said to me, you know, your job is not a measure of you as a person. And that's like shocked me. So he said, he said to me, you know, you're smarter than I am. I said, yes, I am. And he said, you're very mathematical. You could do what I do. I said, I have no idea what you do. He said, come down to Wall Street. I'm going to introduce you to the economists. You're going to see what I had no interest in business whatsoever. I told my mother I was thinking about pursuing a degree in finance because he was moving into a big house in Teaneck and we were in a tiny apartment and we had no hopes of going anywhere. I had competed for a tenured position at one of the best universities. I'm only 23 years old, and I'm going to get this tenured position in a university. Great. I'm going to go right to the top. I'm really excited. I open a letter, and I look at the bottom. It says you're going to make $14,000 a year. You know, so how am I going to be able to afford it? I wanted to have a big family because I had a very small family, just my sister who passed away at a young age, and me and my father died at a very young age, and I actually have outlived my entire nuclear family. It's hard to believe, and I'm still, you look at me, I'm still in my 40s, right? So the fact is I've outlived my whole family, so I wanted to have a good, long life. How am I going to be able to afford that? So I told my mother I was thinking of looking into Wall Street. My mother said, classic line, we're not money people, we're book people. That's what my mother said to me. So I asked her, first time I ever asked her something. My mother had told me that I couldn't be a lawyer because you needed to know somebody. That's what she said, to be a lawyer. So they'd already talked me out of the law years ago. And then this is the first time I started to question. Why did I start to question my mother? Because I had a wife, right? So wife is always telling you behind the scenes, you know, your mother doesn't know anything. So I said to my mother, why can't you be book people and money people at the same time? You know, and she didn't have an answer. So I went into Wall Street to meet this person. And that's the first lesson I want to say. You have to branch out and you have to know things. And you have to realize that you get a lot of sincere but misguided advice from people who don't know anything whatsoever. They love you desperately and they want you to do the right thing. But my mother didn't know anything. My mother studied medieval French literature and was a reading specialist. She didn't know anything about Wall Street. She didn't, you know, whatever. I remember when I found out that my mother prepaid her mortgage. I was sick, you know. She gave up the whole tax advantage and whatever. I said, why'd you do it? She says, oh, it's not good to owe money because Polonius said neither a borrower nor a lender be. So her financial advice came from Shakespeare, right? So, you have to realize. So the first thing I tell people is that you have to be selective about. You should talk to everybody, but you have to basically look into other things. You have to read widely and look at other things. And the other thing you have to do is you have to look at what's going to be around in the future, because we're in a world where things are changing like crazy. Let's say you wanted to be in the travel business. How's the travel business started since the internet? I have a daughter who's in the music business. She works for Sony BMG Music. She's a, you know, executive and artist in repertoire, you know. I sent her to Wellesley College, and she hangs around with hip-hop artists. You know, it's a lot of Yiddish and Nachas, we call that. So I remember the time she called me. I was on the phone, and she said, oh, I have to go. One of my artists just was arrested for carrying a gun. So, you know, this girl went to Frisch, right, you know. So anyway, my interests, so I was working, pursuing graduate students, and I worked in yeshiva education, which I didn't like at all. I wasn't suited for it, and I was thinking of my major interest in life was studying Torah. So was there a way to finance a life of Torah that would permit me something I've done for the last 45 years, learned 8 hours a day, but still make a living? Now, happily, I'm not a sleeper. I sleep about 3 hours a night because I'm what they call a somnambulist. I fall deeply asleep right away. I train myself to do that. You need rapid eye movement sleep. You only need 3 hours of it. Most people have to sleep for 8 hours in order to get the 3 hours. I can fall asleep deeply right away. I sleep for 3 hours, I'm up, and I'm up for the day. So I was able to always learn 8 hours a day, but also have the opportunity to do other things. So I wanted to know if there was anything that I could do that I would enjoy, that would be fun for me, that would be like a game. It would also pay me a gazillion dollars so that I could have a big family and I could afford their education and whatever. And the other thing that happened to me, I happened to be born, I lived in Philadelphia, and I was born to commoners. But somehow I married somebody from royalty, and somehow I had daughters who are princesses. I don't know how that happened. I'm just a commoner, you know, but this is what I wound up with. So I encountered, here I was when thinking about this, I was in my early 20s, and I'm already teaching, and I encountered the writings of a Jewish-American psychologist with roots similar to mine. His parents came to the U.S. from Kiev in the Ukraine, and my paternal grandfather, right, who's another generation more for you, came from Zhytomyr, also in the Ukraine. It was the birthplace, of course, of Chaim Nachman Bialik, and Samuel Friedman, by the way, who was the Chief Justice of Manitoba, was also born there. Okay, if you remember that name, I remember him. Okay, when I met my wife's maternal grandfather, actually, he told me that Jews from the part of the world where I hailed from were just a bunch of horse thieves. That was my introduction to my wife's family. And by the way, the Toldot Aharon, by the way, is Rabbi Aharon Mi Zhytomyr. To my knowledge, he never stole a horse. Anyway, this particular Jewish-American psychologist's name is Abraham Maslow. And I read his works. And I was never interested in college, but I just came across it, and I read widely. Maslow hailed from Kiev, which wasn't all that far away from Zhytomyr, and his most famous idea was very, very helpful to me. After studying successful people, He concluded that exemplary people, he called them, operate with a hierarchy of needs, with very basic needs at the bottom of the pyramid and higher order needs towards the top. So his work encouraged me. I read this and it like blew me away. His work encouraged me to look at what I would want from a career. It gave me a way to balance my spiritual needs, right, my economic ones, and my needs for what Maslow calls self-actualization. And I realized I didn't want self-actualization from the job. I get self-actualization from my family and from Torah. Torah would be my vocation, but something that could support my family, that's what I needed for a career, okay? So I'm thinking about it in this particular way, right? And part of the thing that happened was I thought to myself, if you ever woke me up in the middle of the night and you said, what are you? I never would have answered, I'm a teacher, I'm whatever. I don't define myself by my job, and I learned that lesson from my friend. If you would wake me up in the middle of the night, my wife has tried it actually and done this and asked me, what are you? And I would answer, I'm a father, I'm a Jew, I'm a Kohen, you know. I would never answer with a job. My job would never, I always hated it when somebody said, oh, you're a banker, oh, you're a rabbi, oh, you know. No, you know, it's a funny thing today in shul, if the rabbi came over, he asked me my name, so I gave him my name. So then he called me up, he said, oh, why don't you say Harav? I don't call myself rabbi. You want to call me a Rav, you can call me a Rav. But I don't, you know, that's not my name, you know. I'm just me, that's all. So I was thinking about what I wanted to be. So I quickly eliminated a number of professions. The NFL. Maybe I'll be an NFL player. So there, but there are occasional Shabbos games, so I eliminated that. How about ballet? Mixed dancing. So I did what I tell students to do today. Read, investigate, talk to people. Tell your kids, your grandchildren, read, investigate, talk to people. If you went into travel business now, it's a lot different business than it used to be. Orbitz has changed things, right? There's a family that had that had 20 taxi medallions for generations in New York City. Guess what Uber did to their family business, okay? I'm not talking one way or the other, but I read recently a report in an economic report that 80% of bank loans outstanding, collateralized by New York City taxi medallions, are in default. That business is changing. It's going away. You want to be an elevator operator? Guess what? It's all done by computer now. You go in the building. The guard tells you go to Bank B. You get on there. You don't even push a button. It sends you to the floor for security reasons, okay? I tell students to look at the world's largest industrial companies 100 years ago and see how many of them still exist. And you get advice from your parents. They give you on the basis of history that's not there anymore. For instance, I asked them if they ever heard of a company called, and people here will have heard of it, right? Ever hear of a company called Olivetti? What did they make? They made typewriters. I asked these kids about typewriters. They've never seen a typewriter in their life except in a movie. Typewriters don't exist anymore. I said to a kid, at one time as a kid, I thought maybe I'd be a Rubik's Cube repairman. That doesn't exist anymore. Who's hanging around with Rubik's Cubes, okay? So lesson number two, research. Consider things outside your comfort zone, right? And part of that lesson number two is plan for the next 25 years, not the next 25 months, not what's hot now, right? Longer than that, it's hard to project. Now, here's lesson number three, reach out to people of all kinds. So I reached out to neighbors and friends to find out what was there. I tell students, you can tell your kids, go on the web to a big job site and see what jobs are being posted. Then you know who's hiring. Don't talk to people and they'll tell you what, oh, this is good, that's good, you know? No, look and see. It's all on the internet. Go look and see what jobs are hiring, what jobs are posted out there, right? And if you don't see something in that field, then there's nothing going on, right? So that lesson number four was also important. You know, your job does not encapsulate you as a person. It's what you do for a living. It isn't your life, okay? So when I was the head Japanese yen trader for Bankers Trust Company in New York, my wife actually did. I used to get calls in the middle of the night and I'd have to go out and, you know, trade. And by the way, I discovered something in business. Whenever you get a call in the middle of the night, nobody's calling you with good news. They're not calling you to say, hey, by the way, you know, Tony, that position that you had, you just made $1 billion. No, calling to tell you you're underwater. That's why they call you, you know, and you got to do something. So I'd get woken up in the middle of the night. And I have to say, if somebody had asked me, what are you? I wouldn't have said a yen trader. right? My most frequent response, my wife reported to me that I said when she would say to me, what are you, when I was sound asleep, I would say a Jew, right? And the second most frequent response I would give is a father. Never once answered anything related to my job. If you do answer when somebody asks, what are you, tell them your job, that's sad. That's a prescription for unhappiness when you eventually reach the point that you can retire because you defined yourself completely by what you did. Okay, so I went in to visit Bankers Trust Company. I had no idea what they did, and I met the chief economist, Alan Lerner, and he sat and, you know, and he asked me a whole bunch of, like, math questions and whatever. The one thing I would tell children is excel in algebra. You get tested on algebra and simple geometry your whole life in our educational system. And somehow it's a measure of intelligence. I was great in algebra. I, like, peaked in the eighth grade. I was great in algebra, right? So the fact of the matter is I would always get 800s on all these things. I didn't know. I took the GMATs then. He told me, take the GMATs, the exam for graduate business school. I got a perfect score. I didn't know anything about business. Why? I was great in algebra. Algebra, geometry, and word analogies. That's like the key to everything. Anyway, so I went into there, and I took the GMATs, and I wound up going to NYU Stern. So I left a Yeshiva High School in Brooklyn where I was the principal while I was writing my dissertation, and I went to an NYU Stern, the Stern School of Business, offered me a full-paid fellowship because of my scores in algebra, and they offered me a full-paid fellowship, and they said you can have a full-time job. So what did I do? For 2.5 years, I worked full-time and went to school full-time, but NYU paid for it, and that was great, and it made it possible for me. So I was off and running, and it turned out I loved it. So I had lost my interest in mathematics in college because it became a construct in and of itself. I was always good in math, but it was a construct in and of itself. Then I discovered statistics and probability, modeling life, and being able to, and I found it heroic. And I was really interested in it, and I got very much into probability and statistics, and I wound up studying more and more finance. And at the end of the MBA program, I came home to my wife, and I said, you know what, I think I want to continue for the PhD in finance, right? Maybe I'll be a professor of finance. So my wife said, just excuse me a minute. I said, what are you doing? She says, I'm going to go pack you a suitcase. I'm sure there's a motel nearby. So instead, I went to interview at Bankers Trust, where they had been so kind to me, and I got a job. Now, my friend is a terrific character. His name is Jay Pomerantz. He was one of the best people I learned with. He was an ordained rabbi from Yeshiva University, but a fantastic trader. So I never told him, because I didn't want to presume on his friendship, that I was interviewing there. So I come in for the interview on campus. And it's someone interviewing me is named S. Mark Hinckley III. I never knew people with numbers in their names before. This is like an introduction to me to what my grandmother always called Der Goyische Welt, you know? So here I am, the S. Mark Hinckley III. So he interviews me. They ask me a bunch of questions and all that. And then as I'm walking out, he says, I just have one more question for you. I said, yes. And he looks into a piece of paper and he says, have you ever been in a ritual bath with a lizard in your hand? So that is a Gemara, Hatovel v'sheretz v'yado. So I said, like Seinfeld say with Costanza, you know, or Newman, I said, Jay. I knew that he had said that, so I knew Jay knew. And then they called me in for an interview in the trading room. So as I'm walking through the trading room, I don't see Jay. But all of a sudden, as I'm walking, I happen to be a Kohen, and as I'm walking across the floor, I hear somebody in the trading room singing the top of his voice, V'ha-Kohanim, you know, as I'm walking in. So that was my introduction to the trading room. And what I discovered is I'm a pretty competitive person. I loved trading. So I found I was lucky. I fell into something that was perfect for me. It's mathematical, it's conceptual, it's competitive, and it pays. And I really, really liked it. It was a fun day for me in that trading room. And I was there, and then I went to Chemical Bank actually recruited me to leave there after a while because they said, who's the kid who's doing all the... Oh, I'll tell you an interesting story. So I was there 6 months, and I get a call from another numbered guy, John McBride Price III. They're always the third. I always wonder what happened to the second, you know? So I get a call from this guy. I used to laugh always when my brother-in-law would always, I'd invite him to something. He wouldn't say it's Barry, you know? He'd say, A Barry Weintraub will attend. I used to say, oh, A Barry Weintraub? What happened to B and C Barry Weintraub? You know, I would be confused, right? You know, so anyway, so I get a call from this John McBride Price III, and he tells me that the Saudis want to, he says, is it possible? Somebody told me if anybody could figure this out, you'd figure it out. So he says, yeah, and I've only been in the business 6 months. He says, is it possible to create a 10-year, like, interest rate swap? They're just starting, but in yen, against Swiss francs. There's nothing in the market, but could you figure it out? So there was a thing called a VisiCalc, which is an early version of, like, Excel, and I did something. I came up with something. I came back, and he says, this is great. This is brilliant. So he goes back to them. He sells the idea to these people. And next thing I know, somebody comes running across and says, your transaction's in Euromoney magazine. I'm so excited. I run to get a copy of Euromoney magazine, and I see, yes, John McBride Price III has done this great transaction. You know, it's in his name. Okay, so I learned that, you know, you got to watch what happens on Wall Street. It was a good lesson for me and everything. So, I'm ready to move on. And then I get a call from John McBride Price III, and here's what happened. At that time, we're talking about the late 70s, early 80s. So in the early 80s, everybody in Wall Street was a captive of the Saudi Arabian Monetary Authority. You know why? Because those are the booming days of crude oil, and they had all the money, petrodollars, and they owned the U.S. bond market. So Bankers Trust, like, fell all over themselves for the Saudi Arabian Monetary Authority. So they called, they saw the transaction in Euromoney, and they called the chairman of the bank, Charlie Sanford, and they said to him, we want this transaction. We are really interested in this. So he says, who's the banker? He says, it's something created by John McBride Price III. So he calls personally. He's the chairman of the bank. He calls John McBride Price III in London, and the guy says, I don't have any idea how this works. He says, there's a kid in New York. I was still a kid. He says, there's a kid in New York. He did the whole thing. So I get a call from Charlie Sanford's office, not the chairman himself, but I get the call from Charlie Sanford. He had a very distinctive Southern accent, so I knew it wasn't him. And I get a call and said to me, we're sending down a visa thing for you. You're going to Riyadh. Okay, I'm going to Riyadh. Okay, this is a new one for me and whatever. So they send me down the visa form, and it says in it has my name, and they already have all my information. But they kindly filled out my religion. It said Seventh-day Adventist as my religion. So I called the guy back, and I said, I'm not a Seventh-day Adventist, I'm a good trader. I never pay retail prices. So he says, yeah, we know you're an Orthodox Jew. We know that. He says, and they know you're an Orthodox Jew, but you have to say you're not Jewish because they won't let you come into the country if you say you're Jewish. So here's what happened. I'm 6 months into my career. I had just slaved for 2.5 years, going to school full time, working full time, and put my wife on. We had one child already, and put her on where I never saw the kid except for Shabbos, and I'd leave before he was up, and I'd come home after he was asleep, or I'd come home just when he was going to sleep, and of course rile him up, and then she had to deal with it, right? And she really sacrificed for me to do this. So I call her up on the phone. First thing I do is I went to the men's room, and realize now I'm, 28 years old. I went to the men's room. I went into a stall, and I cried because I knew my career was over. I knew I'd be fired because I could not, in good conscience, tell people I was a Seventh-day Adventist and I was going to refuse to go. And you have to live your life a certain way. I just couldn't do it. My family wasn't involved in the Shoah and everything, but I was just talking to my new friend Elie Rubinstein and reading the book that he wrote about his father and the experience of Hungarian Jews who lost the whole family first. I read that book over Shabbos. It's haunting me. And had to restart and came to Toronto and restart a family and all that. And when I look at that and I say, we had it really, really easy. So I'm just going to go off to Saudi Arabia and pretend to be a Seventh Day. I can't do that. So I cry in the thing, and then I call my wife. And my wife says to me, look, she says, you'll go back, you'll teach at Brandeis. You weren't made for business. You can't do this anyway. So it was a mistake. You had your little dream. Now go be a professor, and we'll be poor for the rest of our lives. And, I can go to Lohman's. I don't have to go to, and she's laying the guilt on me and all that, And I'm thinking, I remember what goes through my mind. I'm thinking, this is the woman. She did sacrifice. So this is the woman who walked around me 7 times under the chuppah, like I was the center of her life. And now I discovered actually why she did walk around me. She was looking for my wallet. Anyway, so I go home, defeated. I'm ready to go home, a defeated man. And then the phone rings on the trading floor, and somebody says, you better pick this up. I pick up the phone, and it's Charlie Sanford, the chairman of the bank. And here's what he says. He says, hey, boy, what's happening down there? So I tell him the story, and he says to me, it's a matter of honor and integrity. I will not let you go to Saudi Arabia. You stand up for what is the truth and what's important to you. He's a Southern Baptist. Okay? Lesson number four. There are wonderful people in the world who are not Jewish. And we raise our kids sheltered from the real world, and we don't know that there are many wonderful people. And I travel in the world, and I will tell you, and you know, you can tell this to your friend Donald, that everybody around the world wants one thing, just like we do, a better life for their children. That's what they want, you know? And so there are crazies too, but most people, most normal people, right, and there are normal people, are good people. I encountered the same thing at CIBC where the chairman was Catholic. His name was Al Flood. And when I was the treasurer of the bank, they wanted to have a meeting on a Friday night. And he said, we can't because our Mr. Glickman has a 5,000-year prior commitment, you know? And that's from a Catholic. Who gave me problems in the bank? Jews. Yep. Okay, that's another story to remember. So the fact of the matter is, this fear of the other, hatred of the other, it's self-defeating. We need to wipe that out of our children, okay? So anyway, the story isn't over, and I'm just going to tell this here, but we're not going to publish this end of the story, but I just want to tell you what this man did. Amazing thing. So it's a few months later, and I wound up going my first trip to London, first business trip I ever had, and I met them in London, and everything worked out okay because the bank insisted that they took a chance with their biggest client. They told him they'd have to go to London. They wouldn't let me go to Riyadh, okay? So this is a man of integrity, and a few months later, I get a letter from the Israel Bonds office to let me know that the Bankers Trust Company has purchased a significant number of Israel bonds in honor of your integrity. Southern Baptists. Okay, so good lesson, right? Good lesson. Okay, so I moved on to a chemical bank, and I began to have a tremendous amount of success as a trader. And I was a young man, and I was a little bit arrogant, you know, as chataay ani maskir. So there was the head of the bank who would only call me when he needed something, would never, ever, and I had had a deal when I came there that my area would get 20% of profits, net earnings before tax. So we were extraordinarily successful, and the bank would have owed me a payday that would have been more than he got paid. So I noticed then all of a sudden in my P&L, I'm getting a piece of the chemical bank jet. I never used their jet. I'm getting charged for athletic clubs. And he says to me, well, the reason you can make money is our name, because we have all these things. So what he's trying to do, he's trying to keep my compensation under his. So I wasn't a real big fan. So I did something that, you know, I tell the both sides of this. So he calls me up on the phone, and he says to me, do you know some what duration is? Duration is a common measure of interest rate risk that any first-year student in Cy Sims knows exactly what duration is. But he's the president of the bank. He doesn't have a clue what it is. So he says to me, I won't say his name, but he says to me, I'm bringing down Sam Armacost, the chairman of Bank of America. Put up some fancy computer program that you've written to show him how I use duration to manage the bank. Now, the day before, you've just told me that you're going to, you know, not pay me what you owe me, and now you want me to make you look good with Sam Armacost. So Sam Armacost comes down on the floor, and he's got his little entourage, and this president of Chemical only walks with an entourage. He's got, like, all these toadies behind him, including my boss, whose name was S. Waite Rawls, guess what? The third. Okay, so he's walking with him, right? And they and Tom shows up and says, oh, you know, here's the area, here's the man that executes my ideas using duration, he says to me. So he says, show Mr. Armacost what we've developed. And, you know, it's hard for me to bite my lip, and that's what I would have been. I'm not Rabbi Karapkin. I'd be a terrible rabbi. So I show him what it is, and he says, oh, this is great, you know, because he did know what duration was. So he says to me, what do you do here? So I said, I'm Tom's Jew. He says, excuse me? I said, I'm Tom's Jew. He said, don't you know whenever you have somebody like Tom running a bank, they have a Jew that he has to go down and take credit for his work and have him explain what he does. So my boss, S. Waite Rawls III, is banging his head on a pillar, you know. I can't believe that you said that, you know. And they couldn't get rid of me because I was the biggest moneymaker in the bank. It was wrong what I did, I admit it, but people in the bank still talk about it. And the fact of the matter is, when the bank wanted to do business with Paul Reichman, who was very, you know, friendly to me and very supportive of me and a man that I believed in a great deal, when they wanted to do business with Paul Reichman, this gentleman represented that I was his very closest associate and almost his protege, you know. So why? To play the Jewish card, right? So anyway, but the interesting reaction is as S. Waite Rawls is banging one, two, and three parts of his body against the pillar, Sam Armacost says, you know, I have a Jew too. So he says to my president, he says, can I have my Jew call your Jew? You know, because in those days, this is before Asians were invented, and the Jews did all the math on Wall Street, right? So I did all the math, so, you know, whatever. And I actually, you know, it actually worked out better. And there are other stories with me and Tom that I can't tell that are some of my greatest wit ever, but they're not for a shul. Okay, so anyway, so we left, you know, so I eventually, you know, left there, and I went to, they wanted to move me to Europe to run Chemical Bank Europe, and I went over there, and I saw a couple things, and I was very interested, and my wife was interested, because we thought we could be in Israel for every Yom Tov if we're living in London. We jump over to Israel and whatever, we'd be in Europe. My wife said, oh, we'll be doing skiing vacations, you know, and all that. No, we won't. So I investigated, and two things bother me. One, the state of education, Jewish education in London was awful. I couldn't see a school that I could put my kids into. And then the second thing was I saw that the market was completely overbuilt. Just completely overbuilt. And I said, you know what? There are more and more people trading, more and more people making markets. What you want to do is start a limited partnership, they weren't called hedge funds yet, that can deal in all these things and pick off all these banks, and that's what I'm going to do. So I left Chemical Bank, and I started a fund that did very well. What they weren't called hedge funds yet. And I had a fund that was located in the GM building in New York. And I did a 5-year, you know, fund, and I was very happy, and everything worked out nicely, and I left the banking world. And then at the end of the 5 years, I had written it as a 5-year thing for tax purposes, so I'm done. And I get a call from McKinsey, the recruiters, who said, you've attracted the attention of CIBC Wood Gundy, the investment bank. Would you be interested in running arbitrage trading or proprietary trading for them? So I said, well, I'll meet them, and I meet the, you know, whatever, and I wind up going to CIBC Wood Gundy. Do I have a few more minutes? Can I go on? Okay. So I wind up going to CIBC Wood Gundy. So I'm going to be running global trading for them out of New York. So they make a dinner for me at a restaurant called Livana's. I don't even know if it's still open. Is it still open? Anyway, they were well known for their venison and all this kind of thing and whatever. So those are the old days. I should say that in the past year and a half, I lost 110 pounds. So those days are over of me in kosher restaurants and whatever. So, by the way, I'll give you my diet exercise. I invented this, my diet program, diet and exercise. So I came up with that, you know. You just stop eating too much and eat healthy and exercise. And guess what? I'm going to patent it. I should write a book. You know, anyway, okay. So, I lost a substantial amount of weight. My old suits, one of my old suits, a homeless family is living in New York. That's how, you know. And I was at the point, by the way, that the U.S. Postal Service was about to grant me my own zip code. That's how heavy I was. So, you know, I'm glad to have to lost that. I was telling Rabbi Kelman that I was at a Tavern on the Green in New York for a venture capital cocktail party, and I was actually, like, amazed. I called my wife. I said, a woman, an elderly woman, just came over to me and tried to pick me up. That hasn't happened in years, right? And she says, go for it, my wife says to me. So anyway, I come back, and the woman wants to talk to me more, and I'm thinking to myself, isn't this cute? You know, a woman much older than I am. Then she tells me she's exactly my age, you know? So, you know, I'm thinking to myself, you know, in my mind, I'm still 22. I guess I'm not. So anyway, the fact is, I got a call from them, and we're going to have a dinner. So all these CIBC executives fly in from Canada, from Toronto, to come to this dinner to welcome me to the bank. Well, who should be eating in the restaurant but George Soros sitting with Paul Reichman eating? And Paul Reichman had been on the board of CIBC, and it was the Canary Wharf disaster, and the bank he had almost taken the bank down, right? So they were like really, really, they see Paul Reichman there, and they're all like crossing themselves and, you know, whatever. So Paul Reichman sees me, and he knows me from the Jewish world. So he gets up to wash. As he goes by, he puts his hand on my shoulder, and he says, Rabbi, and he goes to wash. And I see them, we just hired Paul Reichman's rabbi to run trading? You know, I see they're like, their eyes are like going around like, you know, spinning in their head. So I know they don't understand, non-Jews, that rabbis like can be like an academic title, right? It's somebody, he's a rabbi, he's not necessarily a clergyman or something, and whatever. So apparently, I found out later, they got a private detective firm then to investigate, because I'd always kept my two identities separate. I never talked about business things. I always had two identities. I had two LinkedIn accounts. I had Ozer Glickman for my teaching, and I had Tony Glickman for my business, right? And as I told Rabbi Kelman, what would happen is Facebook will very often say to me that Tony Glickman is somebody that might want to know Ozer Glickman, right? You know, but I never combined the two. The person who spoke to me, I was having tea. I was in London, and I got invited when Lord Sachs was the chief rabbi. He invited me to have tea at his home because he had heard of me, he wanted to talk to me. And he was the one that encouraged me. He said, why don't you speak about the intersection? Because I know how crazy you are about all the cheating in the Orthodox community and how it bothers you so. Why don't you begin to embrace it? Now you're at a point in your career that you can. And then we were having, tea. And then I invited a friend I thought would like to meet you for the second half of the tea. So who comes in but the Archbishop of Canterbury? So, you know, you have to see the scene. It's Lord Sachs sitting in the middle, Arch, Ozer, Arch, you know. And well, I'm hanging out with the Archbishop of Canterbury, who, and I'm biting my tongue because I don't want to embarrass my host, who was rabidly anti-Israel, right? So I didn't want to, you know, embarrass him. But in any case, I owe it to him and to Ephraim Mervis, the next chief rabbi, and to Rabbi Warren Goldstein from Johannesburg, who all encouraged me to speak about, you know, business issues and the intersection with halacha and not to have a bifurcated, you know, existence. So I come to CIBC, and they come over to me and say, so you're a rabbi. Now they know the whole story and whatever. And I didn't like working in the investment bank. So at the end of 2 years, I said, I think this is it for me. And so they said, well, don't leave. Why don't you become the treasurer of the bank? So to take a trader and put him in charge of the whole balance sheet, I mean, that's the best job I ever had. I mean, it was fascinating for me. You'll have to be in Toronto 3 days a week. My wife says, go. So that's how I wound up here. And had a wonderful, wonderful time. And, you know, it was 9/11 more than the closing of King Solomon's Table that really ended it for me. But I had a wonderful time here, and I've very good friend who I spent a lot of time with here that I'd just like to mention, Beryl Besson, if you know the Besson family, very close friend of mine, and we spent a lot of time together while I was up here. Dove Friedberg is another friend of mine, and I had spent a lot of time with him, and David Novak at the University of Toronto. These are my good friends in Toronto, and they made my life, and Julia Ching, a philosopher of Chinese thought, who was kind enough to study with me, and Father Paul McIntyre. I was interested in canon law and the intersection with Jewish law, so I studied with them at the, and I became also, while I was up here, a fellow for the Center for Religion and Philosophy at the University of Toronto, which is a fabulous school. It's a fabulous school. So I had a wonderful time here, and I really, really enjoyed it, and I just came to the end of my, you know, of my tenure. But these lessons need to be shared with kids. I will say, just in the area of Nachas, I have six children, you know, and some are, I spoke today at Shalosh Shudas about the one who was an academic who turned out to be a huge success, you know, because you have to, kids are all different. They need to be educated in different ways. But my oldest was the valedictorian at Frisch and went to Gush and then Harvard, and he's a hedge fund manager, and he lives in Teaneck, and he has, you know, four children. And my second is in Israel now trying to decide if she's going to marry her boyfriend or not. And she went to Wellesley, and she's an executive in a record company. And my third, who was my problem kid, didn't go to yeshiva in Israel. He went instead to the Army. He had a stellar career in the Army and was hired by El Al and was recruited away from El Al to work for Etihad Airlines, the Abu Dhabi airline, despite the fact that he has an Israeli passport in addition to a, you know. And he now lives married to a Syrian girl and lives in Brooklyn and has a little baby, Maimun Yakita. She speaks, they speak Spanish to her because her mother is Syrian from Mexico. As her, my mechutenet said to me, the president don't like us. Anyways, but I told her not to leave the country, not to leave the country because she may not get back in. But I did promise her, I made this commitment to her, if she does leave the country, she can't get in, I will parachute in to JFK in a ninja costume and liberate her. I promised her that. And my fourth, who worked for David Letterman, Maya had a baby and now is on a second baby, and she's married to a guy from Teaneck who is a producer for Nickelodeon. My fifth, who's going back to do a post-bac in nursing, is married to a fourth-year orthopedic surgeon resident from Baltimore, Yona. And my sixth is at YU, where he's majoring in something called Max Live. He runs the broadcasts of the, you know, basketball tournament, and his big time is Saracek. And it's amazing that we've had a very good run in the school, and the professors are amazed at how this kid that doesn't read really somehow has my writing style in his papers. So, as you know, I have a Daila Hakima Bermiza. So anyway, Kaddish Baruch Hu's been wonderful to me from a boy who was extremely unhappy at the death of his father and was cast adrift and alone, and wound up sent away from home by his mother to New York to live his father's dream. 15, 16 years old, a sophomore in college, away from home for the first time, saying Kaddish, crying himself to sleep every night, to the point now that I went on an exercise program just because I love my life and I want it to go on just the way it is for many, 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 many years to come. So there's a lot of life lessons in here that that I try to share with students. And the reason that I teach in YU, why I work in YU on Tuesdays and Thursdays, but you know I still work in the real world, is because I want to share these kinds of lessons directly with the next generation of Jewish kids. We unfortunately have a business model that the successes when orthodoxy was going to disappear in the 1970s, Marshall Sklar, the sociologist, wrote, he said orthodoxy will disappear completely. What saved it? Why he wrote before he died, why he wrote in the 80s that it had changed? Day school education. That's what changed it. And the business model for day school education is broken. You can't saddle young families with a pre-tax tuition bill. They have five children. They're going to have a pre-tax tuition bill of five times $30,000 a year plus dinners and all that, and orthodontia and clothes and rent and mortgage and all that, so that it's something only for the wealthy. It's not the way that it should be. Rabbi Kelman has a very good idea that I'm going to try to learn more about for how to fund this over the next several years, and you know, we have to do something, but I have to see that these boys know. So what do I do? If I'm there for Shabbos we have a base, we have a shmooze where the Rosh Yeshiva come for Shabbos. And kids will, after dinner, they'll sit there and listen to me and then ask me questions for 4 or 5 hours. And I will talk to them always. I give a talk. I gave a talk in YU. What's on the Rosh Yeshiva's Kindle? Important. The Rosh Yeshiva has a Kindle and he reads literature, right? Because literature is important to understand life. And I tell them they should read the Wall Street Journal all the time. They should read the New York Times Book Review. They should be engaged with the world. This is Torah Umada, and it's very, very important for them, you know, to do it. And the most important thing that I tell them is that not everything, and this is in the words of my teacher, Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who said that not every life situation has a se'if in the Shulchan Aruch. There's not a place in the Shulchan Aruch you can look up what to do all the time. But there is one verse that tells you what you should do all the time. It's in Parshat Ve'etchanan, and it says, Vasita hatov v'yashar b'nei Hashem. You shall do what's good and right in the eyes of God. And that's a catch-all, the Ramban says, for always think, what is the right thing to do? And that's also Torah. So Torah is not defined only by kashrut. It's not defined only by the length of skirts. It's not defined by what we let or don't let women do. It's not defined by how much we spend on weddings or, you know, whether we are able to be Zionist, which means in Tinek going to the Inbal for Pesach. It doesn't mean, that's not just that, that's all part of it, but it's also being a good and a just person. So I tell the kids, either you put that verse in your car or I give them a little card to put in their wallets they carry. It's called the Glickman Rule. And here's what it is. If you're in business and you can't, and you have a moral dilemma or you don't know whether you should do something, you're not sure if it's permitted or not, take out my card and read these words. Would your mother be embarrassed if you did it, if she found out that you did it? If she would, don't do it. That's Hatov HaYashar Bnei Hashem. And that's the way I live my life, and that's the lesson I'm trying to do. I very much enjoyed, I was for my great niece's, she's loving this, she's got her headphones on, she can't hear a word. So I was at my great niece's bat mitzvah here, I got a chance to hear Rabbi Karapkin, and he's a wonderful man, and we've been in contact since then. And I'm sorry that he was away, but I do want to say I gave a shiur in the YU Torah Mitzion Zichron Dov Kolel on Friday, and I do want to tell you that we have two of our most wonderful graduates here that I'm very proud of, Rabbi Mordechai Turchiner and Rabbi Jonathan Ziering. These are wonderful people. If you have a chance to hear them, give a shiur. I know that they're here a lot, and whatever, great opportunity. These are the finest that YU produces. These are really, really wonderful people, and this is a great place, and I hope to be back here again, and I thank you very much for coming. I'll take any kind of questions or anybody wants to ask something, and everybody has to leave, please, by all means. Yes, ma'am.
I really enjoyed your speech. Thank you very much for coming. Rabbi Sachs also was extremely depressed when his father died. Did you
ever
have to discuss that with you?
No, I haven't had that privilege. I haven't had that opportunity. You know, we have a young man in town that used to be here for YU. We put him here for YU, and now he's a businessman. He's doing very well. His name is Mo Litsky. So he heard me today, and he hadn't heard me in many, many years. And I said to him, so I have gotten older. So he says to me, you're much better. And he says, because now you speak personally from the heart. You used to come here, and you had to do, you know, show how smart you were. Now you're speaking from the heart, and that's what people want to hear. And that's what the Talmud says. Tvarim hayotzim min halev. When you speak from the heart and you share yourself, it goes into other people's hearts. So that's what I tried to do. I had a wonderful time at Or Chaim for Shabbat. It was just, thank you, Jay, for inviting me. Really, thank you. It was a wonderful Shabbat. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention, I promised I would mention it, that Elnatan Kelman is my favorite of all the Kelman children. So I promised I would say that. Okay. Anybody else have anything you like? I'll stay in the front here. Yes. No, and I'll tell you why. So on that, I lean on the Vilna Gaon, who said the following. So he says this in Shnot Eliyahu, a Pei Rishon, the Mishnah Brachot. The Torah tells us, the tradition tells us, lo yamush sefer zeh mipicha yomam v'layla. You have to be involved in Torah all the time. V'hagita bo yomam v'layla. So how do you work? How do you live in the real world? Here's the answer. He says there's a part of you that's always like an operating system. He doesn't call it that, but that's what he meant. That's always in your unconscious. And I'll tell you what it is. So I always have, I'm always a Torah personality. I could be trading. I could be talking about something. And I give you an example. But all of a sudden, there's thunder and lightning. And I stop and I make a bracha. Because I don't have to stop and think. Because it's always resident in my brain. It's always there in the background, right? And, I'm always in active idle mode in Torah. And the other thing I would say is that I tell the boys that want to go to law or Wall Street or medicine or something, I know basically the Talmud Bavli by heart. I can say over most of the Talmud. So when I'm in a meeting and something and things, I'm a little bit bored or something and I'm listening, maybe I'm learning. You know, so I'm able to get extra time that way. If we're at a party, I'm not a big small talk person, as you can tell, I'm very shy. So when we're at a party sometimes and my wife sees me spacing out, she'll come over and whisper in my ear, Me'itach Gisa, you know, to wake me up, because she knows I'm thinking about Talmud when I should be talking about our grandchildren's toilet habits, right? Because that's what we're doing socially at, whatever. So the fact of the matter is, it is always resident in your mind. The other thing I would say is what I discovered, I got a whole new career thanks to Rabbi Goldstein, is that I've been told I get consulted now by Batei Din around the world because they tell me there are many people who know finance and there are many people who know Choshen HaMishpat, but there's not so many people who know finance and Choshen HaMishpat. So I answer a lot of questions related to like mortgage structures and derivatives and things of that sort. And I have to say, by the way, I fell in love with finance. I fell in love with statistics again. I fell in love with math. I fell in love with the writings of Daniel Kahneman, an old friend. I'm very engaged in what I do. And what I tell the boys, it's not something you do for a living. It's Mada. Used to be the Torah Mada was the Beit Midrash is here and the science lab's over here. That's Torah Mada on the YU campus. With me, it's Mada Lamana Torah. Everything that I read, everything I think, enhances my Torah thinking as Torah enhances my other thinking. It's a quick story, okay? When I was in business school, I wanted to sign up to take a law course in securities law with the famous law professor at NYU Law School, Homer Kripke. By the way, relative of Saul Kripke, the philosopher from Princeton. So I wanted to take a course with him. And I went to the course, and I'm sitting in the course, and he said, you've had contracts. I didn't have contracts. I wasn't a law student. You've had contracts and you've had torts. Question is securities law contract or torts? Somebody explain that question with an example. So all the law students are scared to death. They're sitting there. So I raised my hand. And he says to me, go ahead. And I said, you're an investment advisor. You promise to make somebody 5%, but you lose them 10%. If it's damages, you owe them the 10% that you lost them, because I know what nezikin are, damages, right, from the Gemara. If it's contracts, you owe them the difference between 5% and what you promised them, minus 5% and 10%, so you owe them 15%. He says to me, correct. He says, are you a 2L or a 3L? Meaning, and I said, neither, I'm a Talmudist. He says, you better stay and talk to me and explain that. So I went up to him afterwards, and I told him that when I was 5 years old, learning with a tutor, I learned in the Talmud that if a doctor promises to make your leg better and he makes it worse, the Talmud says the big discussion is, does he owe you for the damage or does he owe you the difference between what he said he was going to do? I did that kind of reasoning at the age of 5. The fact of the matter is I never ran into anything in the business world that taxed my mind the way a long Tosfos does, right? Or even worse, the short Tosfos that are elliptical and you don't know what they really are. So the fact is, I'm always in Torah mode, and I'm always in finance mode, right? It's integrated. That's what we call Torah Mada. And I'm actually, Richard Joel says I'm the quintessential YU type personality. This is what we're trying to, what we're trying to do. We're trying to teach our kids to live in both worlds, to bring wisdom to life. That's what they should do. So I don't find any bifurcation at all, okay? Am I getting the signal? Okay. Yes, anybody?
I'm going to ask a personal question.
Please.
Over the whole weekend, everything that you've been talking about, but how do we educate our children? Let's just say that's your main goal. What do we teach the next generation? So I find basically we don't teach any of this in any of our schools. And maybe it's a little bit of a breaking thought, but you went to a public school. Lord Jonathan Sacks went to a public school. Many of the great thinkers of the Jewish world did not go to a yeshiva. And I'm just wondering, is there something that that we don't teach the thinking and the critical analysis that we'll get in an excellent public school, but you know, I mean, you won't get to get achievement. What can we do to improve it? This is all great, but most people, you know, don't get an 800 on their GMAT, and at 5 years old, they don't know those. But for the average person, what can we do? And not everybody's interested in finance, and unless you go into finance, you can't make the money to support your kids to go to day school.
Well, one thing we have to do is we have to make it affordable to everybody. This is ridiculous, the way that it works now. And I'd say that education is not the responsibility of the parent alone. It's the responsibility of the Jewish community. So I'd like to see the Jewish community something. If I was going to have something that I'd work on, it would be to make Jewish education affordable for children. It used to be in the old Chicago Kehillah, by the way, in the early 1920s, that there was a fee, a little tax on every act of shechita that went to pay for Jewish education, right? So we need to come up with something that supports, because you can't put this on the parents alone, right? So it's you know, it's in all our interest for continued Jewish survival. I went to public school because I lived in Philadelphia, where there was no decent school in my day. I wouldn't have gotten a good Jewish education, a good secular education. So there was a school that was for the academically talented. My parents sent me there, and I had a tutor, and I learned with a tutor. And it was good for me but it takes a certain kind of kid. I don't know that my kids could have survived there. I walked into high school. I was younger than all the other kids. I was 11, and the other kids were 13. And I walked in the first day to gym class in the locker. I took my shirt off, and I was wearing tzitzis, and a kid made fun of me. So I pushed him into a locker and closed the door, and nobody ever made fun of me again. But my kids are not. I was Tony from Philadelphia, you know? I'm Tony from New Jersey, right? I'm not in waste management, but I got the temperament of Tony Soprano, right? So the fact of the matter is, I don't think my kids could have survived that. You know, I took two buses, you know, from Shellmeyer all the way out to Central, you know? I took two buses. My kids have to go like 3 feet. Can somebody take me? So the fact of the matter is, like, we kids need to read. Ask children, by the way, so you know what I did at YU? I had a thing. I said, I've never sat in my office in YU once. I sit in the commons where the kids hang out near the coffee, and I sit and I learn there, and I say, come by and talk to me. So kids come and talk to me. Sometimes you see a kid will walk by you three times, you know he wants to talk to you, so you have to smile at him and tell him to come up. And, I did a thing there in the commons, and I wound up having about 60 kids. I took the tweets of Bernie Sanders when he was running for president. I went through I analyzed them for the economics, right? You know, so I analyzed for the economics, and the economics were pretty flawed, right? So I took the tweets, and then I took the tweets of other candidates, and I analyzed them to teach these kids how to think. Now, do you have any idea how poorly educated our kids are when it comes to history? No concept whatsoever. I mean, what's going on? We don't teach that. We spend too much time on Talmud before kids are able to learn Talmud, and they wind up. Now, here's what I want to ask you. Kid graduates from high school. He took 4 years of Spanish. He probably speaks better Spanish than he speaks Hebrew after 13 years of yeshiva education. Is that sick? That's unbelievable. How come every kid can't go into, you know what my kid used to do? And we spoke Hebrew in the house, but the little one had problems with it because the other kids had left. The older kids would always teach the younger ones. So when my kid was in yeshiva in Israel and he had to order a taxi, he would text me, and I would write him the text in Hebrew, and then he would copy the text and send it to the taxi thing. And then he says, I'm in a restaurant. I want to get, do I ask for a 300 burger in klum? He wanted it without the vegetables. I said, no. And I would write him out. And he'd stand there with his phone, and he'd have to read what I mean, that's terrible. Should be able to speak Hebrew. This is my house where everybody else spoke Hebrew, you know? So the fact of the matter is, we don't teach Hebrew. We don't teach history. We spend time on there. Our yeshiva teachers think that they're mini Rashi yeshivas. So kid is in my shir, he goes to teach in Mariah, and next thing you know, he thinks he's like the Rav. You know, he's like, you know, you teach Chedushim and whatever. These kids, they need to learn Mishnayot. They need to read Yud Lamed Peretz. They need to read Bialik. They need to read history. They need to read every day the Wall Street Journal and or the New York Times or the Globe and Mail or whatever. They need to know what the world is all about. And we don't do that. You know, we have a very, very skewed education. Well, so our schools, in my opinion, I was the chairman of the Board of Frisch for many, many years. And I have to tell you that we tried to work on that, but I have to tell you that a lot of times the attitude in yeshiva high schools, I travel all around the country, all around the U.S., and I tell you, a lot of times the idea is just keep these kids warm, get them to Israel, and then Israel will teach them. Guess who's teaching them in Israel? People that are teaching them in Israel, they, you know, and I always say that I go visit the Israeli yeshivot, and I say to them, why are you teaching these kids that they shouldn't go back to college? Why are you teaching them that you go to Touro or something? Why do you do that? Do you think if they go to Touro or Neir Yisrael, do you think they're going to wind up sending then their kids to your Zionist yeshiva? It isn't going to happen. Why do you do that? You know, why do you have this, like, look over my shoulder, you know, black is better? Why do you have that? I don't, you know. And I come from a family. My late sister was the chairman of Black Hats Matter, right? Remember in Philadelphia, right? She was the chairman. That was her organization, you know. So the fact of the matter is, you know, we don't have to have. But her kids, she was very firm. But two of her kids, including my niece here, are doctors, right? They got educations, and your mother made it clear to you that you would go to college and graduate school in whatever you wanted to do, although she told you that you'd be a doctor. Right. So the fact I know. Okay. So the fact of the matter is, we need to have expectations for kids. But here's the last thing that I'm going to say about this. You know, when the heat breaks in your house or the plumbing goes down, who here calls a rabbi to ask him what to do? I don't call. You know, I stand up in YU and I answer questions after a Musser Shmooze. And the kid said, Rebbe, I said, anybody have a question? The kid says, yeah, can Rebbe give us, I love they call me in the third person, can Rebbe give us tating advice? Here's what I tell him. Yes, don't ask a Rosh Yeshiva for dating advice. No? Ask your parents. Ask somebody, an older sibling. Ask an older cousin. Don't ask a Rosh Yeshiva for dating advice. It's not Das Torah, right? So when our schools make their decisions based on rabbis, rather than people with business sense, that's a big problem. Somebody called me and said, why don't you become the president of YU for 2 years and fix it? You were very successful in a bank. Why don't you fix it? And I said, here, take a piece of paper. I'm going to tell you exactly what I learned. Don't spend more than you take in. Now you know what I know. That's what you need to do. That's what Jewish education needs to do. And rabbis don't know this stuff. We don't teach it, you know? You get a fresh face out of YU, rabbi, or Neir Yisrael, or some other place. He learned Yeridane, he learned some Gemara, and he learned a little practical halacha. What does he know about running a business? A school is a business, right? We need more fiscal responsibility in the Jewish community. We don't have it. And by the way, he doesn't know about education either. So I'm in favor of, you know, people with broad education and experience in life contributing to the life of educational institutions. When I was the chairman of the Board of Education at Frisch, I didn't put rabbis on the Board of Education. I put successful men and women who knew what it takes to succeed in life as an Orthodox Jew, and that's what I did. And by the way, because the school had other kinds of kids too, terrible sin. I also took non-Orthodox people and put them on the board. Right? They also can contribute. Right? And the amazing thing that I tell the kids at YU, where do you get into business? And you're going to find out something really amazing. There are really smart non-Jews in the world. Not everybody is Jewish. You know? And they're shocked by that. You know, I have a team of 9 engineers who work for me in my, you know, I sell an engagement to a financial institution. I map it out. I tell them what they're going to do. And then they read computer code for me and do modeling for me. These are 9 engineers. They all went to Princeton and MIT. They're all Asian, every single one of them. How come my firm can't find kids from YU to hire, you know? And I'm looking where it's possible. Quick story, because I don't want to drag this out, but I had a young woman in Stern. I taught one course in Stern. I had a young woman in Stern. I'm teaching options theory and how it relates to something called Asmachta in Kenyan. So I'm actually putting on the board something that a Dayan in Manchester didn't understand, that options have an intrinsic value even before expiration, so they're not really speculative gambling, right? So I'm putting this on board. And it's something that Bob Merton won the Nobel Prize for. So here I have this young woman sitting there who is the first person in her family to ever go to college. She went to Bais Yaakov, and Bais Yaakov wouldn't send her transcript to Stern, so the math teacher did it on her own and sent it to Stern. She comes to, and she sits there, and I ask a question, and she, a light goes off, and she, on her own, figures out intuitively the insight that Bob Merton did to win the Nobel Prize. So I said to her, can you stay afterwards? Do you have a class? No. I said, I'd like to have coffee with you. I'd like to talk to me. So I talked to this young woman. She tells me the first person she had to fight, they had to tell her father to let her come to college. So she's in college. She's brilliant. She went to a terrible high school. She learned all this stuff on her own. She had a big autodidact and whatever. She gets like an, I was looking to give an A triple plus to this young woman. So what do? I get her a summer internship at Goldman Sachs. And then her father, she says, my father needs to talk to you. Her father comes and talks to me, and it turns out he's Israeli, but he's Haredi Israeli, and he works in the diamond business, but not as a diamond dealer, but more as a cutter and whatever. And he says to me that I'm going to turn his daughter's head, and she's not going to get shidduchim because she's going to be too smart and too successful. So I explained to him, I asked him, I said, what do you make? So he says to me, he tells me what he makes. I said, do you know she's going to make about three times that just for the summer? You know, I mean, please, you know, she can contribute to the family. You have daughters. So now he decided that the next girls are going to go. So over the summer, after she finishes her, she's going to let the other girls go to college. She sends a note to me and she says, can you write a recommendation for Queens? Because my father says I have to leave Stern because it's too expensive, because now he wants my sister to go to college too. And he can't afford two at Stern. So I call the administration and I tell them, you give this young lady a full scholarship or I resign. She got a full scholarship, you know. Now she's graduating this year, and she's going to be full-time at Goldman Sachs. They loved her. And guess what? She'll be married. She'll have children. But she will have stemmed the tide of ignorance in Borough Park from where she came, right? That's also a mitzvah, right? That's also a mitzvah. And the other thing I tell these boys is, I always tell them, I said, guess what? I taught in Stern. Guess what? Women understood the stuff better than you did. Important for them to know that, you know? Important them to know that, you know? My nephew Jason knows that your wife can be a lot smarter than you, right? He knows that. And why does he know that? Because she's a blood relative.
Exactly.
Right, okay. Anyway, so the fact is that, you know, we need to offer equal educational opportunity for women, too. And that's Stern College. That's what it does, you know? Yes, ma'am. Absolutely.
You see, that's the basic principle that has to be expressed and to be taught, not in math or this or that. You've got to come in and say, like you said, the goyim are, some of them are wonderful.
Right.
Wonderful to history, literature. You should know about right. Everything. But again, it's more than just...
So I want to tell you something. So you know what I did? We just finished a project with my little engineers. And we finished a project. We're at State Street Global Advisors in Boston. And we finished this big project, so they want to have a big thing in my business, consulting, is celebratory dinner. So we're all going to go to Prime Grill, because I'm in charge. So we're all going to go to Prime Grill. So I tell them an hour and a half before, and these are all kids that all they did is science and STEM, right? So I said an hour before, I want you to go to this address and meet me. So they all, I have nine Asian kids there and their Uncle Tony, right? So where do they meet me? We're outside the Metropolitan Museum of Art. So I take these kids in who have never read or looked at a work of art with anything other than to get an A in a class at MIT. And I take them up to show them Monet. So I take them to see a painting called Le Jardin et Agente, The Garden Agente, my favorite painting, right? So I take them to see it, and I say, what do you see there? So one of them says, well, there's a woman, it's probably his wife, but he probably has some kind of psychological block because she's blurred, and there's a big dahlia bush or something. So I said, okay, and I solicit. Then I read to them from, I have to do education with these kids. I read them from Guy de Maupassant. Remember the story of the necklace, right? So I read them this, from Guy de Maupassant, who went to see Monet paint. And he says that Monet would come out to the garden, and he would set up his easel, and he'd paint 12 hours. Every hour, as the light changed, he would paint the same scene. So I told them there are 11 other versions of this scene. Now they begin, you see the wheels begin to turn. They begin to appreciate. So then they want to see whether or not they get anything out of it. And I point out to them that really the hero of the painting isn't the bush. It's not his wife. It's the light. Okay? They look at it. You see the light go on in their eyes because they think in Excel space and spreadsheet space. Now they see there are other things to think about. We go to Prime Grill, and my favorite of all of them, a single child of a Beijing family whose parents sent her to Princeton because they wanted her to get out of China and have opportunity. And she came and she speaks beautiful English and whatever. You never know, she's not American born, but she's here from China. And I said to her, Ellen, they all have like, you know, like we have names. They all have like, you know, they're the new Jews. So they all have like non-Chinese names too, right? So I said, Ellen, what did you order? So she said, she starts to answer and she says, oh, no, no. She says, I learned something. She said, I was going to say I ordered the pasta, but I realize now that the pasta is the dahlia bush. What I really ordered was the sauce. I said, you learned something. You learned something about life, you know? So I view this in both in business, too. I view my job as being, you know, an educator. I mean, I have parents that taught me to appreciate literature and to appreciate art, and that it is also avodat Hashem. It's also, we live in a beautiful, beautiful world with beautiful, beautiful things. The most beautiful is Torah, but Torah gives us a lens to look at a lot of other beautiful things as well. So anyway, listen, I thank you for attention. I don't want to keep you too long. So thank you very much for coming. I hope to see you all again another time.